Hi, I'm Mike Dilk and you're listening to the Relax Back UK show, the show that explores all kinds of health topics relevant to you, your family and your friends. Each week I talk to expert guests from a range of backgrounds to inform and entertain you. So please do join the Relax Back UK family and stay tuned.
Hi and thank you for joining me on the Relax Back UK show. Two very different topics this week. First of all, the results of phase two trials for a drug to help with a rare form of leukemia.
Now the phase two is out and being reported in major cancer congresses. And actually, we take it that survival from that 5.6 months to 13.4 months. Usually you don't get any responses, and we're seeing over 60% of patients respond to this treatment. So it looks like it's going to be a game changer for this population.
I talked with Dr. Juho Jalkanen, Chief Executive of Faron Pharmaceuticals. Then, how do you decide what to have for breakfast?
Flavour came as in fourth position.
Some surprise results from Rosie Hook, the Senior Brand Manager at Lizzie's, and Dr. Neil Buttery, a food author and podcaster. So please do stay tuned for a great show. Thank you. The first guest today, Dr. Juho Jalkanen, CEO of Faron Pharmaceuticals, spoke of the phase two trials of a drug being developed to help with the rare form of leukemia. And Juho has been on the show before.
Yes, I have. Thanks for having me again.
Well, thank you very much for coming back. So that hopefully the first experience wasn't too bad for you.
Not too bad.
And you got some news. You guys, you've just done a phase two trial, one at Manchester and one at Truro, on a drug to help with leukemia, the same drug you were talking about last time. So, well, two things, I suppose. What's the name of the drug and what happened during the phase two trials?
Yeah, so drug's name again was bexmarilimab, but we call it Bex to make it a lot easier for everybody. So Bex it is. And since we last went, then we were entering phase two. Now phase two has been completed. It's been running in the US, in the UK, and in Finland. And again, in the phase two, we've been treating this rare form of very deadly leukemia that doesn't have a treatment, named RRMDS, myelodysplastic syndrome. It's a leukemia where the macrophages have gone wild. So that's the cell type that's gone wild and taking over, and then normal red blood cells, white blood cells are not produced, so you're deeply anemic and neutropenic. You get a lot of infections and blood transfusions. So it's a very poor condition to have, and then life expectancy is only 5 to 6 months. And now the phase two is out and being reported in major cancer congresses, and actually we take it that survival from that 5.6 months to 13.4 months. Usually you don't get any responses, and we're seeing over 60% of patients respond to this treatment. So it looks like it's going to be a game changer for this population.
Okay, so it is a dramatic improvement. It's not a cure, but it's definitely an improvement.
It's a dramatic improvement, but there's also possibility for cure, because the actual only cure is a bone marrow transplant. But to be eligible for one, patients need to go into remission so you can do the transplant. And now we get the majority of patients into remission and they're eligible for a transplant. So there's a possibility for even cure from this otherwise deadly cancer.
Okay, so in that instance, remission, I normally take remission to mean a cure, but it doesn't in this case.
It does to some extent, but usually you lose it eventually. So that's the thing.
Okay. All right. And so these phase two trials have been done in the UK. Have they been done elsewhere in the world or just in the UK? And if so, why just in the UK?
No, they've been running in the UK, in the US and in Finland. So
all right.
It's a real global trial, not just the UK.
Okay. And what's the reasoning behind that, to make sure that things are the same the world over, or, you know?
Yeah, you want to kind of see that it looks similar no matter where it's done. It gives you confidence that the results are, in a way, true. Because if it's, one single center, there may be something peculiar on how they do stuff. So that's why you do a good spread. And also with something new like this, something revolutionary, we want to be working with world-leading sites. So that's why we have the best in the UK and the US and Finland.
And this is the kind of the next part of the process and what is actually a very long story. You know, you've been working on this, and I think other family members of yours have been working on this for a long time. Tell us a bit about that.
Very true, but that's drug development for you. So we've been, we're down to the second generation doing this. Originally, the molecule was found by my mother, who was the professor of immunology. So this was discovered in her university lab. My parents set up the company, but really understanding the target and how to manipulate it, how to design the drug, all this takes time. And then the company then is a bit younger. And actually, the actual drug is pretty young that went into the clinical studies. But altogether, we've been working over 20 years around this.
Goodness me. I mean, that just shows how time-consuming and difficult, well, first of all, the initial basic research and then drug production. You know, this stuff takes a long time.
Takes a lot of time and a lot of money, and there's no quick fixes here. There's no, you know, wonder tricks here. It's just resilience and hard work.
Yeah. Okay, now I'm going to ask you an impossible question to try and explain kind of the approach, condense that 20 years experience into a few seconds. The drug you're using takes an immunotherapy kind of approach and enables our own immune system to attack the cancer. Is that true? Is that a fair summary?
That's a very good summary, and high level that is. More specifically, like mentioned, we target the macrophage. That's a cell type, immune cell, and the purpose of the macrophage as a part of the immune system is to go around, eat debris, dying cells, and foreign matter like cancer, and present it to the immune system. And a part of the immune system, the T cells, are the actual kind of soldiers or killers that then go to kill cancer, but the macrophages needs to present cancer to them. And the problem here is that the macrophages are not presenting what they eat and find, but we make them present again. So now the cancer is revealed to the immune system, and the immune system can attack it again.
All right. Now, to make the macrophage kind of wake up or do what they're meant to do, how do you do that?
Through this wonder drug we got. Bex does it. Then we go to such detail and technicality of what happens in the macrophages that I'm not going to even bother you with that. That's a secret sauce.
Okay, so the drug Bex kind of makes the macrophage work properly. So is the fact that people have this sort of cancer, is that what stops the macrophages working?
Yes, exactly. So this form of leukemia, MDS, the macrophages have gone wild. So they're all over the place, gone wild, not presenting. So again, that's why we make them behave again.
Okay. Now, I'm pretty sure in the press release, it spoke about clever cells, cells that are called clever. I don't know if they really are clever, but that's what they're called. They're involved in that somehow.
Yes, so clever is the receptor we're targeting, and it comes from common lymphatic endothelial vascular endothelial receptor. So there's a, you know, background to the funny name. So that's the receptor we're targeting, and that's a, you know, master regulator of the macrophage.
All right. So you need to. So does that mean the clever cells are kind of turning off the macrophages? So you need to hit those clever cells to stop them turning off the macrophages.
The macrophages are clever one positive. So the macrophages are the clever but cells themselves. And when we hit them with Bex, again, then the clever goes down and they're not clever one positive anymore, in a sense.
Okay. All right.
So we're an antibody against clever. So we're a first in class, unique, and the clever one antibody.
All right. So the drug interacts with the clever macrophages. How does it do that?
By binding to them. So clever one is a scavenger receptor. Mm-hmm. So basically what the macrophages uses to eat stuff with. And again, the purpose of the macrophage was to eat and present what it eats to the immune system. And these clever one positive macrophages, they're the ones that do not present what they eat. Okay. So when we bind with the antibody to clever one, it starts presenting what it eats.
All right. So this binding, is that coming up with a molecule, the drug that's the correct shape? Is that kind of the
key? In a way, yes. The correct binding site. So this is so-called high affinity antibody, so and very binding site specific. So it's all down to the binding and binding to the right place on this receptor.
And that's the difficult bit. That's the 20 years.
That's what took many years.
Okay. So you've managed to sum up in a couple of minutes what, you know, has taken a whole team of people 20 years and
exactly.
I dread to think how much money.
Yeah, let's not mention that.
No. Okay. All right. So you found a way to block these clever cells, which is a type of macrophage, to stop them behaving in the incorrect way. Is there any downside to doing that? You know, does that block anything else that is kind of useful?
It's actually. There's not too many downsides, but no drug is perfect or completely without any downsides. But again, this is not toxic like conventional cancer treatments are. So it's very well tolerated compared to conventional treatments. What we do see with this drug, but again, it's pretty rare that the immune system may become overactivated. So the immune system may be attacking too much. It's just not attacking necessarily the cancer, but it's also attacking your own tissue. But this is luckily very rare and it's been well managed, taking the patients off the drug, if this happens.
I'm going to ask a question now, which may show my complete misunderstanding of the whole concept. So with me a moment.
Yep.
Whatever makes these clever macrophages go wrong or require to be blocked, is it as simple to say it's the cancer that does that, or is there something else that's happening? Could you go kind of one step up and attack whatever that one step up is and try and turn that off, or is that a silly question?
So it's a good, very good question. I'm going to take it one level up. So we're talking very basic biology here. So you get these clever one positive macrophages in states of inflammation, for example, to come down and dampen inflammation. You find these in pregnancy, especially in the placenta, because the fetus is half the man and half woman, and it's foreign to the bearing mother. Half of it. So the placenta, which is a kind of an immune barrier, the placenta is filled with these clever positive macrophages. And then if you get inflammation, then they come up. So they're needed. They're an essential part of the immune system. And when something needs to be tolerated or T cells need to be inactivated, so then it comes into play. And now certain cancers have hijacked the same thing to, you know, have it for their protection.
Okay. So, yeah, all right. So we need it.
It's a part of our basic
cancer,
biology,
really.
And we play with it. So, so that's the thing. It's a part of natural
human
biology, and we've learned how to master it during 20 years of working
with
it.
Very good. Here's another question, which is, it might be in the same vein. You're doing this to help with types of leukemias. If you're using such sort of very basic human biology, could this kind of approach help with other types of cancer? Maybe more, you know, cancers that are more solid type of cancers with tumors.
Yes, yes, indeed. What we actually know is that a lot of different cancer types use this, again, for their protection, have hijacked this biology for their benefit. And especially we see this in very hard to treat nasty solid tumors as well, like liver cancer, brain tumors, sarcoma is a one very nasty cancer, and they have the same mechanism for protecting itself from the immune system. So this is actually a problem in a lot of cancers.
So this potentially could be very useful in quite a few other areas.
Exactly, yes.
Okay, that's interesting. And are there thoughts on those other cancers? Are they developed enough to yet to have trials and phase two trials and all that? Or is that way ahead?
No, phase two trials are starting in a number of cancers, actually. Now that we got these good results in the first one, the lead focus again, which was the macrophage-specific cancer, now a number of phase twos are starting in other cancers.
All right. Okay. That is good news. I got to ask you a question about AI, because everyone is talking about AI. Okay, artificial intelligence.
Yeah.
And again, on the news release, the press release, there's a picture of you holding models of different shapes, and that's where I got this idea of, you know, these different shape drug fitting in to the clever macrophages that are causing the problem. And I saw this and I thought, okay, this is a very specific kind of shape problem. That must be just the sort of thing that AI can help with, to envisage shapes in 3D and what might fit into what. Now, that's just the thought of a layman.
You're absolutely correct. That's where we use AI. Understanding basic biology, AI cannot actually be used for that, I would say. Again, it takes a lot of work understanding basic biology. But designing molecules, how protein folds, those structures, there's certain laws, and you give them to AI. AI can say how something forms and shapes and where it could fit. That it does well. That's where we use it.
And you are using that at Farren right now?
Right now, to design some second generation molecules targeting Clever One.
Okay, fantastic. All right. So, you know, it's all happening. You know, there's an awful lot going on.
All coming together.
Yeah. All right. So now is probably a good time to ask, what's the next part of the system? You've done phase two trials. How many phases are there when you're bringing a drug to the market? You know, how many more phases you got to go through, and what are they?
There's only one last phase. It's phase three. That's kind of the last phase, and that's where we're entering. So it's getting intense.
Okay.
A
phase three trial, how many people does that involve? And actually, how many people did the phase two?
The phase two was 53. And then the phase two here was 53. The phase three is, again, some hundreds pages. So we're actually max 400.
400. Okay. So because this is very important, because so people realize that, you know, this wasn't done with a couple of people kind of popping into the lab. This is serious stuff. This is done with hundreds of people.
Yes.
So there's a good chance that it's going to work for every individual.
It's looking very good in that respect.
Okay. Is this kind of treatment, do you have to be a certain type of person? You know, will it work for everyone, or do you have to have, you know, does your genetics have to align with this certain type of treatment? Do you get tested to see if this thing might work for you?
For this form of leukemia, you don't need that. But again, when we go into a number of other cancers, then you should get tested that you have these Clever One positive macrophages. So then you have to be a certain type, and we have a test to do that.
And are most people of that type, you know, or is it, you know, half of people or 10% of people?
Again, in this rare form of leukemia, it's basically everybody. So no patient selection test needed. But again, screening biobanks across all cancers, I would say 20 up to 30% have this across, again, all cancers. So that's a lot of people.
So you said for this current thing, looking at very nasty types of leukemia, you've done the phase two, you're entering phase three. If you're gazing ahead into your crystal ball, how long does, you know, the phase three take, and how long till you'll be able to say, right, this is the drug, it's been through all the tests, it's now ready?
Well, here's the thing. Phase three takes usually 3 to 4 years, but in the setting we're in, where there's, again, no treatment options really available, there's a thing called accelerated approval. So while running the phase three, the drug could get already approved earlier because there's nothing available. And if it's shown, you know, it's well tolerated and efficacy, it can get approved earlier while still running the phase three.
Good luck with that. It does sound very exciting. Well, I mean, for you personally, seeing as it's the culmination of 20 years work with you and also other members of your family.
Exactly.
Fascinating stuff. If people are listening to this and they want to find out a bit more, but they're not scientists, you know, they have a bit of general knowledge, but they're not experts, you know, they haven't spent the last 20 years looking at this.
Yeah.
Can you suggest some potential sources where they could, I guess, sources for the layman, where they can find out a bit more, find out how it works, that kind of thing?
Well, they should, you know, start visiting our website, faron.com, F-A-R-O-N.com. There's good information also for layman's. Then there's a lot of links where you can go deeper and deeper as you want to go into it.
There are links to detailed papers, etc.
Detailed papers, but websites are pretty, you know, approachable even for a layman.
Okay, very good. That sounds excellent. Now, the results from the phase two trials, they're soon to be published. Are they published yet? What's the deal with that?
They actually were just last weekend presented at ASCO. That's the leading cancer congress in the US. And this weekend, it's the European Hematology Association annual meeting in Milan. They'll be presented again upcoming weekend in Milan.
Okay. Oh, all right. And are you doing that or a member of your team?
A member of the team. So it's the actual investigators, the treating physicians from the leading hospitals present the data.
Good, good. All right. Well, look, good luck with that. I hope that goes very well. Juho, thank you very much indeed for taking the time to chat. You know, this is absolutely fascinating. Can potentially help, obviously, many people. So many thanks.
Thank you, Mike. It's exciting times ahead.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
So my guests to talk all about breakfast are Dr. Neil Battery, a food author and podcaster, and Rosie Hook, senior brand manager at Lizzie's. So my first question was, is breakfast really the most important meal of the day, or is that just a catchphrase?
Well, most people are eating breakfast, so I suppose that there are data to back that up.
Well, most people eat lunch and dinner as well, don't they?
Well, they do indeed. Not everyone is eating breakfast, but what was quite encouraging, I think, anyway, because I think breakfast is an important meal of the day, that a lot of people are returning to eating breakfasts rather than skipping them, and returning to eating breakfast so they can lose weight, because, of course, you know, you miss breakfast and quite often you end up, you know, snarfing down a lot of, you know, bakery products, walking down the high street.
Okay, so it's a way of maybe not eating and snacking on things that aren't quite so bad for us. Sure, all right. So, Dr. Neil Battery, then, as an evolutionary biologist, are you kind of well placed to assess the changes in breakfast, our breakfast habits over the last couple of days?
Well,
evolution is normally a bit more sort of longer term, isn't it?
Longer term, yes, it is. Well, evolution's equipped us with some certain behaviours and preferences, I suppose. Things that used to be rare back in the days of, you know, Stone Age man or whatever. So things that were rare were sugary things, high protein things. So we're very much geared to eat too much of those, really, these days. Oh, and salt as well, that's another thing. So, you know, we have to do a lot of...
So we're programmed to crave these things.
Yeah, and really hunt them out, I suppose. And, of course, it's quite easy to hunt them out now. You just pop down the supermarket or pop into a cafe. So it's hard, okay. It's hard to make the right choices because, yeah, evolution has really equipped us with this set of rules that don't necessarily fit in the modern day.
Yeah. All right, so, I mean, so there have been changes back to kind of shorter term. What did we eat like 20 years ago? And things have changed, have they?
Well, it's the variety that's changed, really. People are still eating the things that we think of as traditional, like cereal. You know, 49% of people are regularly eating cereal for breakfast. And things like toast and crumpets and all those sorts of things. But then you've got all these new kids on the block from the last 20 years or so, you know, people are eating more Danish pastries and things like that, or continental pastries. There's smashed avocado, there's protein shakes, wheat germ drinks, all loads of different things now. So it's a real uptick in variety.
Okay, so there's a massive choice. So what kind of factors influence what anyone might choose out of this massive choice to have for breakfast?
Well, the vast majority, two-thirds, are saying it's all to do with making a healthy choice to try and improve their health. That's number one. Flavour came as in fourth position.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So it's things like convenience, functional foods, so things that are, you know, things that people are very mindful of these days, or some people are anyway, gluten-free choices, low-sugar choices, high-protein, those sorts of things.
Right. So food is fuel only for breakfast, it might appear.
Yeah, I suppose so. I think for a lot of us, that's how we do it. And often we don't stick to the straight and narrow, do we, when we're not including flavour in our choices? Because it can sometimes feel a little bit austere, can't it? But it doesn't, yes, have to, it doesn't, yeah, have to be so these days, I don't think.
So lots of variables. I mean, one variable that I've noticed sometimes, if I take the train early in the morning, some people might say, right, I've got to have a breakfast that I can eat on the train.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think it's 28% of people were saying that they're eating their breakfast on the go. So I guess they're making their breakfast or taking it out the fridge, depending on whether they're making it or not, and eating it on public transport or when they get to their desks.
That doesn't sound terribly good for you.
No, I know. It is true, but saying that, I can understand where people are coming from, because for me, I would much rather hit that snooze alarm one more time than make breakfast. So I'm happy to, save time later by maybe eating on the run. but it's probably not healthy.
I have been known to eat in the car.
But that's very naughty.
Is that naughty? I don't know. Because on the train, you kind of irritate everyone around you. In the car, at least you're on your own.
Well, that's true. You might miss a red light, though.
You might, yeah. No, that's
you're
true.
Eating a sausage sandwich. So, can't be having that.
I'm very aware that a Rosie is here as well and hasn't been included in the discussion. Now, you must have something to say about our current breakfast habits as senior brand manager at Liz's.
Yeah, I mean, it's just really interesting to see what people are looking for. I mean, you know, anecdotally, you've got a good idea of what your friends and family are looking for. But just from our survey, to understand how much a desire to improve health does influence choices. And also things like, you know, low sugar, high protein. I was reading just the other day that nearly half of adults in the UK have increased their protein intake in the past year. And that's not just people pumping iron at the gym. People are generally looking for that kind of stuff. So, you know, we just got to be cognizant of what people are looking for and provide it to them.
Should you be cognizant of what people are looking for, or should you be cognizant of what people need?
It's a mixture of the two, isn't it? It's a mixture of the two. People are very much more mindful of their healthy choices, but you want it to be delicious and yummy as well, don't you? So it's a mix of the two.
So you were talking about cereal, or Neil mentioned cereal. He had a statistic or a percentage of the number of people that eat cereal. It was, what was it? It was pretty high.
It's 49%.
Okay. Now, I did a bit of my own research, which is, admittedly, this is not very scientific. But I called my daughter, who's at university at the moment, and at the time, she was actually having breakfast in the halls of residence. So I asked her, how many of your fellow students are having cereal? And she said, well, very few. So I kind of pressed her and I asked her to kind of put a percentage on it. And she came up with 10% of fellow students having cereal, which is kind of at odds with what you said. And I thought to myself, how can those be two such different figures? And I thought, well, actually, the percentage of students that make it to breakfast is probably pretty low anyway. Most of the students are probably still asleep.
Yes,
and so when, I don't when know what they're having for breakfast.
When you're in a hall,
that might be the problem with the statistics. I don't know.
When you're in a hall of residence, though, you've got a whole choice of different foods there made up for you. It's like going to a little buffet at the hotel every morning. So when you've got a choice like that in front of you and it's required no extra effort from yourself, then you maybe going to go for something else, because suddenly, you know, the something that's maybe approaching a full English is just as convenient as the cereal. Because convenience is just so important when it comes to people's decisions. And for most of us...
I felt a little bit jealous, actually, because there were some fabulous things there for breakfast, which I only have if on the odd occasion I'm staying in a hotel or something like that.
No, indeed. And there's a big difference between the genders with this, I would say. I was quite surprised at how many men, when it came to making their choices, you know, one of their top answers was that, oh, whatever my partner's making. You know, because it's just that, well, whatever
partner is making.
Yeah, for breakfast. Yeah, I'll just have what they're having. So, you know, some people just go with whatever's the most convenient. So that's different depending whether you're at home with your partner and whether you're same sex or different sex partners is maybe going to influence that, and whether you're in a halls of residence where you've got a breakfast buffet to choose from.
Sure. I suppose the discussion about breakfast isn't really complete with talking about the Great British Breakfast, which is kind of shorthand for a cooked breakfast, or another phrase for a cooked breakfast. Is that popular? Do people have that?
Well, if you're talking full English, well, no, not really. 11% of people said that they regularly had a full English. But if just taking things like eggs, like scrambled eggs on their own, you know, quite a lot of people are eating those. But of course, you can make so many different things with eggs. There's a whole range of, you know, from healthy, you know, to pretty unhealthy things you can do with eggs. But yeah, 11% having a full English. So yeah, I thought, I mean, I had a feeling it was on its way out a little bit, or less popular. I don't think it's ever on its way out. But I didn't think it would be as low as 11%.
And I think it's also about the opportunity you have to do it, because certainly me, in my world, on a working day, I don't have time to do that. But at the weekend, I'll treat myself with it. So that's when I'd have it.
Yeah, and that is regular. You know, if you have it once a week or even once a month, that's regular.
Yeah, I mean, I've really got out of the habit of eating cooked breakfast. I must say, it's just when I'm at a B&B or a hotel, I have it. I try and be good.
So, Rosie, when you're at work, when you go into work, does everyone have breakfast at work? You know, is breakfast provided by the company, considering what you do?
Well, if people want it at work, it's definitely there for them. I think it depends on people's situation. So speaking personally, I have to have breakfast before I leave the house. It's just how I am. But other people, when you've got a busy life and you're dropping kids off at school or you're doing stuff like that, then yes, there's definitely people who say, right, I'm at my desk now. Now I've got time to breathe and now I'll have it.
Okay. Is there any, this is almost an impossible question, so apologies for asking the impossible question, but I'll ask it anyway. Is there any thought from nutritionists, from doctors, what the best time and the best thing to have for breakfast is?
It's such a complex answer. Everybody's different. So you can't really have a single one answer. And this is why dietetics is such a complex thing, and why dietitians are constantly seemingly changing their minds. You know, one week something's good for you, then it's bad for you. You know, it used to be low fat, now it's full fat. It all changes. It depends on the people. And that's why we're constantly, for hundreds of years, we've been essentially asking that same question, because the right answer is what works for you. And to some degree, you have to work that out yourself. You can't necessarily be told. You can be equipped with what the general healthy things are and unhealthy things are, but then you just have to try and make it work for yourself.
Yeah, no, I get it.
That
all
wasn't
right.
an answer,
so
was
tell
it?
Me. Tell me, both of you, what did you have for breakfast this morning? Rosie first.
I hate to be predictable. I had granola, but I do like it with some added fruit, with some yogurt. Just, you know, makes it, adds some more nutrition to it and just makes it delicious.
What about you, Neil?
Well, I was lucky to be staying in a hotel, so I had a rare cooked breakfast for me.
I bet you really enjoyed it as well, didn't you?
Yeah, it was great.
I had muesli. Actually, it was Alpen and yogurt.
Very good.
So, yeah, we haven't done too badly there on that three-person straw poll for breakfast. Yeah, right. So if people are looking to change their breakfast habits or just find out what else is out there, because we can get in a bit of a rut with our habits, and breakfast is probably somewhere where we can do that. Where's a good source of information on nice ideas of other things for breakfast? And that's probably better going to Rosie.
Yeah, you can certainly go to the Liz's website, which is lizzys.co.uk. And if you add a / Great British Breakfast Report onto the end, then you'll find out lots more information about the survey we've just done.
Excellent. All right, that sounds good advice. Thank you very much to both of you for chatting.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much to my guests on this week's show. And they were Dr. Juho Jalkanen, CEO of Farron Pharmaceutical, talking about the drug they have developed to help with a rare form of leukemia. Then talking about breakfast, there were Dr. Neil Buttery, food author and podcaster, and Rosie Hook, senior brand manager at Liz's. Please do remember, if you have a bad back or you're worried about your posture, to check out the website, relaxbackuk.com. There you can find out all about the back app chair. It has helped many hundreds of people, so it can probably help you too. And you can look at the website, which is, again, relaxbackuk.com, to sort out a trial if you would like to. Thank you very much for listening to the show, and have a healthy week. Until next week.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Thanks for listening to the Relax Back UK show. Join me, Mike Dilk, again next week for more fascinating interviews and chat. If you're listening to the podcast version, please subscribe, like, and share it with your family and friends. And have a healthy week. Until next week.